You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. It's a warm welcome back to paranormal investigator, psychic, and author John Russell and his latest book, 20 Ways to Increase Your Psychic Abilities, hits the shelves worldwide. John and I look at tackling the negative aspects of the paranormal portrayed on television in the modern era, and why we shouldn't ever take for granted the official line on parapsychology and remote viewing in light of the UAP hearings. We'll also look at some of the topics covered in his new book, and revisit one of the loveliest animal ghost stories you're ever likely to hear, featuring Gizmo the cat. But as always, before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. You can also click the link in the show notes as always. Thank you as always to each and every one of my patrons for their continued support for the show. It'll also be launching on the Apple Podcasts Premium Service next week, so if you prefer to sign up that way to get your episodes extra early, then keep an eye out for our social media updates. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to our channel on YouTube, and don't forget you can visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news and merchandise. Thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. So, let's welcome John back as we delve into the world of the paranormal. It's a warm welcome back to paranormal investigator, psychic, author and medium John Russell. With over 50 years' experience in the field, John has a wealth of knowledge, with numerous encounters and offering paranormal assistance. With three books now under his belt, there's always something happening for the world psychic, John Russell. John, welcome back.
Paul, it's so great to be here. We always have such great conversations, and it's fun to talk to each other about the weather there and the weather here and kind of catch up on things. And we just always have a great time. We get to talk about a lot of great things. And it's always a pleasure to be interviewed by you, my friend. I appreciate it.
It's always nice to find time for you to come and speak with me, John, as well. I know we've laughed about this several times since it happened. But obviously, we originally did this interview 5 months ago. And I suffered the awful realization just as we finished that for some reason my system had not recorded our conversation at all.
Right. And as I told you, that happens with me sometimes. There was another UK podcast that we did, and the same thing happened there, and we had to re-record it. I have a history of me and my psychic powers and my guys on the other side affecting electronics and electricity and all kinds of things. So it gets pretty bizarre sometimes.
Well, to be fair, I'm so used to it these days, John. It doesn't happen often. And it was the first time it had happened to me for nearly 3 years.
Wow.
So, yes, you've certainly got a special effect.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, since we've started speaking, John, we obviously this is your third appearance now.
Right.
We've chatted about numerous things. The one thing that's always struck me when we speak about your work, your experiences, your writings, your assistance, is you view the paranormal as a mostly positive experience, which is a real sort of difference to, I think, the modern cultural interpretation of the paranormal.
Right.
Whenever you watch a show these days on television, everybody's frightened out their wits. Everybody's running about screaming. People are going to houses and they're saying to people, oh, you've got terrible evil demons in this house. You need to get out. And then they go and leave them with these terrible evil demons, John.
Right.
Do you think, as with anything in life, when it's something that's in the cultural touch point, they tend to focus on the worst case scenario and promote that far more than the reality of it? Because ghosts and hauntings and things seem to have gone through a real shift in modern culture in the last 30 years to gone from this kind of inoffensive, occasionally shocking hauntings with people just wandering about to close to death, terrifying experiences where people are chased out of homes.
Yeah. Well, it has undergone a big change, Paul, and not for the better. And I do view the paranormal as probably 95-98% positive. In my lifetime, I've had way over 1,000 physical paranormal manifestations in my life that I've experienced now. And all of those have been positive, beneficial, uplifting, and on numerous occasions, not just one, but on numerous occasions, literally life-saving. And I've watched the paranormal zeitgeist change over the years and over the decades. As you mentioned, I've been a professional psychic for 50 years now, and I've watched everything change over the decades, and not for the better. The so-called professional ghost hunters and the so-called professional psychics and mediums and these awful, awful, awful TV shows that portray everything as gloomy and evil, dark, malevolent, menacing, demonic, satanic, whatever. And that is simply not the case. And the reason that so many people are going in that direction is it sells. It puts people's butts in the seats in front of the TV, and they can sell advertising, and they know the shows work, and they know people like to be scared. And unfortunately, people don't differentiate between that and the real interaction with the paranormal. People don't differentiate between horror movies and the real interaction with the paranormal. Now, I have it on absolute ironclad authority, both from people that have been talent, on-air talent, on some of these really well-known, really popular shows. I have it from them, and I have it from some of the people that have been involved on the production side in other venues and things that knows what goes on. That in a lot of these shows, the on-air talent is asked to scream at a certain point, asked, can you work up a cry, asked to jump and leave the room and run out of the room and all these types of things when nothing went on, simply for the sake of provoking a reaction and trying to titillate the viewer, which, of course, does nothing to help anybody, does nothing to promote anything or to promote any paranormal understanding or anything. So what we see on TV is by and large fake or wildly exaggerated or not pointed in the right direction to begin with. And I believe, as we talked before, one of the big names in the industry has been called out now for faking evidence on his TV show. So this is something that goes on. Now, I think the reason that people are susceptible to the idea that there's something demonic or scary or evil or satanic or harmful or whatever, for one thing, we go through this knee-jerk reaction based upon our religious upbringing. And especially if you've had a strong Christian upbringing in the Bible, you know, the Bible approves anything paranormal that's in the Bible. And the Bible is full of paranormal circumstances, floating axe heads and talking animals and the prophet calling a bear out of the woods to eat the kids that were talking. I mean, there's all kinds of paranormal things in the Bible. And with the Bible, it's okay if it's in the Bible. If it's extraneous to the Bible, then the Bible condemns it. So we grow up with that, and anything that happens, if it's not happening while we're sitting in the church pew, if it happens in our home, our knee-jerk reaction is, our default reaction is, oh my God, this must be something satanic or demonic or evil or something to lead me away from the Lord. It didn't happen in the church or whatever. Mm. So we have this knee-jerk reaction. That's where we go. And I think people are frightened of the paranormal, not only for the religious reasons, but they've been told all their lives that it doesn't exist or else it's demonic. So we've covered the demonic aspect, and they've been told also that it doesn't exist. And then all of a sudden something happens on the physical realm that they're not imagining. It really occurs, and people are having to acknowledge, oh my God, there's this invisible realm that's interacting with the physical realm I see. There's this greater reality out there. Now, what do I do with this thing? And is it trying to harm me? And what do I do? I had a when I shot the TV pilot for the History Channel, at one place, this lady came up to me and she said, "Oh, John, I've got to talk to you when you get a break. In the filming, this ghost tried to kill me." I said, "Oh, my God." I said, "No, the ghost, no ghost tried." She said, "Yes, this ghost tried to kill me. I'll tell you when we can talk." And I said, "Okay." So we get to a break in the filming, and I go off in a private room there in the house to talk to the lady. And she tells me that she's standing at the sink washing her dishes, and from across the kitchen, this cupboard opens up, and a plate flies out of the cupboard by itself across the room with such force that it hits the wall by her and shatters and falls to the floor. She said, "See, a ghost tried to kill me." So immediately I knew what had happened was that the other side had been trying to get her attention and communicate with her, as the other side does with all of us. And they had specific things they wanted to give her in her life, specific intuitive guidance they wanted to make her aware of, and they wanted to help her. And she had been ignoring this and pushing this away. And when I questioned her on that, by her own admission, yes, she had. She would get these little inklings or these little happenings or intuitions, and she'd just push them away. And so finally, the other side was so desperate, they were like, "Okay, ignore this. You're not going to be able to ignore this action." And I said, "They weren't trying to hurt you. If they were, they would have hit you." I said, "They're just trying to get your attention, and they're showing you their frustration with you ignoring them." And I said, "Here's how you deal with this, and here's how you open up to this. And now this is going to be something beneficial in your life that helps you." And in another occasion, when Sylvia Brown was alive and was on TV, this woman called me one day and she said, "I saw Sylvia Brown on TV." And she said, "If you want a ghost of your own, just ask and a ghost will come to you." And she said, "I thought that sounded like fun. So I did. And I got a ghost. And now I don't want the ghost." And I said, "Okay." I said, "Here's why." And the interesting thing was, she moved from the house she was in and the ghost followed her. So the new place that she moved to, all of a sudden, the ghost would set off all the car alarms up one side of the street and then down the other side of the street in sequence. And the neighbors thought, "Okay, it's her," because this never happened until she moved in. So they called the police on her. So she said, "John, I'm out there one day, and the police come to the house, and we're standing there on my porch, and they're questioning me. And all of a sudden, all the car alarms start going off in sequence up one side of the street and down the other. And the cops look at each other and shake their heads and go, 'Okay, we're out of here. You're clear.'" So she said, "All right, what do I do?" And I said, "Okay, you asked for a ghost. Here come a ghost. And you got it. And then you didn't want it. You're scared of it. Now it feels slighted. It's got no place to go. It's attached to you. You asked for it. You asked for it to come and be there. And then you're afraid of it. You don't want it there. And you tried to get rid of it. And you moved and it followed you. And it's a little miffed because you tried to leave it behind. So it set off the car alarms and just kind of a, 'Hey, look, you know, don't treat me this way.'" She said, "What do I do?" And I said, "Okay, this is what you do. You talk to the ghost. And you say, 'Look, I asked for you to come. And you came. And you're here. And it's physically evident that you're here. I mean, the cops saw it. The neighbors see it. But, you know, I asked for you and you came, and then it scared me a little bit. And I became a little uncertain, became a little frightened. And I apologize for that. And you haven't harmed me. You haven't done anything to really scare me. And here's what I would like to do. I've invited you here. You're still invited here. And I want you to be part of my home, but just take it easy with me. Let's progress in this slowly because this is new to me and it's a little scary to me. And just work with me on that and protect me and protect the home here. And if I have to go out and you can't go with me, you don't go with me and you stay home, protect our home so that nothing happens to it. Or if you can tag along with me when I run errands or whatever, help protect me and activate my intuition so that if I'm heading in a direction I shouldn't be, that I don't go there and those types of things. Mm-hmm. And I said, that way you become in a partnership with the spirit that you've asked for and it'll help you. And that made sense to her. And so she did that and everything was okay. But we have this, you know, this automatic assumption that anything that happens from the other side is evil or satanic or demonic. That's not the case. And like you said, you know, we've seen this big push in TVs and movies, paranormal investigation, books, Everything you look at now, demon this, demon that, demon chaser, demon hunter, the world is full of demons, houses are full of demons, people are beset by demons. That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life, the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. That's not the case. It's not that way.
I mean, in your experience, John, through all the cases you've had to deal with and all the people that you've spoken to, and as you've mentioned there, several people have come to you and said, this is going on in my property.
Right.
In your personal experience and everything you've dealt with then, you would say the vast majority of disembodied spirits, entities, whatever you wish to call them, ghosts, hauntings, they're fine. They're just sort of mulling about, like you say, like the lady having the plate smashed near her. Often Absolutely. These are like attention-seeking children.
Absolutely. And we have to understand, Paul, it's critical that we understand that these entities, these spirits, these beings, our deceased loved ones, guardian angels, our spirit guides, are all around all of us all the time, right now. The analogy that I use is that if you take a, let's get off the computer and let's get off the phone, let's take an old-fashioned radio you plug in. And right now, where you and I sit, there are all these radio waves, all these radio transmissions going through the air right now, all around us. We're not tuned in, so we don't hear it. We're not aware of it. But if we take that radio and we plug it in, we turn it on, and then we start turning the dial, and the static quits, and we tune in, oh, there's a talk show. And then we turn a little more, oh, there's a country music station. We turn a little more, oh, there's a jazz station. Well, guess what? All that is going through the air continuously. We didn't just invent it when we plugged in the radio and turned it on. It's always there. We're just not aware of it. We're not tuned into it. Well, it's the same way with the psychic realm, the spiritual realm, the spirits around us, those energies around us, those beings and intelligences. Guess what? They're always there. They're all there all around us right now. Sometimes they can manifest physically and interact with us in the physical realm. But with them being there all the time, it's like that radio. We have to learn to plug in, to turn on, and to tune in to that realm and make that accessible to us. And that's the secret to some parts of psychic communication, is realizing that's there all the time and that we can tune into it. And when we do, we can ask it, hey, guide me, help me, show me things.
Have you found more people coming forwards, John, in the last sort of 10, 20 years as the conversation and the reality of the other side, paranormal, has gone from being pushed out to the fringes, because it obviously was studiously studied for quite a large part of 150 years and then sort of pushed away again in the 70s yep. and 80s to fringe subjects and
exactly
pushed down the road with all other kind of new age belief systems, and they were all chucked in this outdated box. And then now, as we've just been saying, everywhere on television, there are certain channels you can probably sit down and watch 24-hour ghost investigations or paranormal discussions and things, John, with thousands of podcasts and documentaries out there these days.
Right.
It seems these days it's far more acceptable. So I'm often surprised when people feel that they can't speak freely about certain things until they discover people such as yourself, or they listen to a show like this, or they catch something on television, John.
Right.
It seems very odd, I think, that you've got this duality, haven't we?
We do, Paul, and you're exactly right. And you hit the dates and the timing and everything exactly on what you were describing, like particularly back during the 70s. I remember it was just, you just didn't talk about these experiences, or people thought you were mad, or that you were hallucinating, or that you were a crackpot of some kind. You could lose your job, you could lose your friends, you could lose your family. So it was pushed way back on the back burner. And then the pendulum did swing the other way, as you said, and it became a little more acceptable, a little more normal, a little more visible. Unfortunately, I think the pendulum, in spite of everything we've done, and in spite of the progress we think we've made, the pendulum always swings back the other way. And I think that's begun to happen a little bit now. I've noticed in a lot of the podcasts that I've been interviewed on that there's a lot of people that are very openly skeptical, to the point that they're antagonistic and hostile toward a viewpoint that there could be a psychic, that there could be someone such as myself that can actually see into people's lives and could accurately and honestly predict their futures. I've run into a lot of antagonism, a lot of hostile skepticism in regard to that over the past year or two. And so it seems like that pendulum is going back the other way. And then, in spite of the fact that, as you pointed out, you know, we have these TV shows, we have these documentaries, we have the U.S. government acknowledging that UFOs are real, that they're physical objects. And now we've had a whistleblower come out and say, yes, we have recovered craft. Yes, we have recovered alien bodies, so on and so forth. And in spite of all of that, people still hold on to this. I don't know if it's a skepticism, a hostility. I don't know what it is, but I think part of it may find its roots back in that extreme right-wing Christianity, where anything that's viewed outside of a certain paradigm is suspect, demonic, evil, satanic, or whatever. I remember watching a documentary about UFO investigators and the remote viewers and our own remote viewers that the U.S. government employed, our U.S. military employed, and that's well documented as fact that that happened. And they were making the statement that there were some members in Congress that were so staunch right-wing Christians that they would say, if there's a UFO, it's demonic. If there's alien creatures, they're demonic. If there's remote viewing, it's satanic. It's an evil source of energy. We don't explore those things. We don't investigate those things. We don't allow those things in. So that's one of the things I think that continues to hamper a real research, real investigation, and people's acceptance of their experiences, as that attitude continues to put a damper on everything. And I think that maybe with all the people that are coming out now and really pushing for a real disclosure, particularly here in the U.S., maybe we're going to get beyond that. I hope so. We have a congressman here, Tim Burchett, that has come out recently and is very, very vocal about, hey, this is ridiculous. Time to let the American people know what's going on. And I believe that he is sincere, dedicated. And of course, being a congressman, he's knowledgeable. They got, after we got our little 9-page report here in the U.S. that was made public, I think Congress got something like a 90-page report, something like that.
Yeah.
And it was rumored that people in Congress were saying, holy cow, this thing reads like a sci-fi novel. so we know it's real. We know it's there. I've had several experiences. Lots of people I know have had several experiences. And so, you know, why the cover up? Why is this being kept under wraps and not disclosed to the American people, especially since it's gone on forever and a day? So that's something I've never been able to wrap my head around. And it's obviously there's some power structure there that wants to keep this all to themselves for whatever reason, maybe money, maybe power, maybe both, whatever. But obviously, they've been able to successfully contain it. Now we've got people trying to blow the lid off of it, and I hope to God they do.
I mean, the thing about everything that's going on, obviously, it's very interesting that the latest whistleblower has had his health records leaked to the press. John, people are questioning his state of mind because if... which once again seems to be flying in the face of the modern tolerance towards people who suffer from mental illness, that clearly this man can't be trusted because he's had a history of mental illness, which I find remarkable in the modern climate where we're supposed to be more open and supportive of people that suffer from this, because you know, there are millions of people around the world who battle various forms of mental illness across the world, aren't they? What struck me about all this, everything that's happened since that article by Leslie Keen and Ralph Blumenthal in the New York Times 6 years ago, I think, was that they'd said for years after Project Blue Book show at the end of the 60s, they weren't doing it. And then it all came out that, yeah, they were actually still carrying on investigating.
Exactly.
Which, for somebody like me, John, makes me think, well, does that mean MK Ultra's carried on then and they've just never talked about it? Has Project Stargate carried on?
I'm sure it has, because it's proven that these things worked. They got results for the governments. And so the government is not going to stop a program that gets results and gives it any kind of a leg up, any kind of advantage over the enemy, any kind of intelligence advantage. They're not going to stop that. And it's just like I remember here in the U.S. when we were told that the SR-71 Blackbird spy plane era had come to an end and that they weren't flying the SR-71s anymore. Well, it wasn't long after that announcement was made that the SR-71s were all grounded and no more flights I went out one beautiful, clear day after lunch and was about to get in my vehicle, and I heard this odd, strange double sonic boom way, way, way off. And I looked up, and there was the clear, unmistakable silhouette of an SR-71 Blackbird flying over. And I was like, well, you lying son of a guns. You know, it's like our government's always lied to us. And we have to understand that that's the model of government, is that they're going to obfuscate, they're going to lie, they're going to divert, they're going to, you know, do whatever they can to keep that power structure in place. And I remember Tim Burchett, he was on a podcast that I had also appeared on, been interviewed on, and I was listening to him one time. And he said, people need to understand the true power structure that's in place. And he said, there was this guy, he was, some big hot shot for something. I can't remember exactly what it was, but he said, this guy, he was there in Tennessee when Tim was becoming, on the way to become a congressman, where Tim was from, I believe, in Tennessee. Mm. And so anyways, he said, this guy was totally stereotypical. Bourbon in one hand, big cigar in the other. And he told Tim, he said, you know, he said, you're going to come and go. Other congressmen are going to come and go. Presidents are going to come and go. But I'm going to sit right here and I'm still going to be in charge. And he said, that's exactly the way the power structure operates. And we have this illusion that, okay, we're going to elect so-and-so and everything's going to be okay. Or we're going to elect so-and-so and prices are going to go down. Or we're going to elect so-and-so and we're going to get the truth. And he says, that's not even close to how the power structure works. And Tim Burchett said on the air, I think more than once, but I heard him once in this podcast say that if he were to reveal to the public right now what he knows, that he would die by suicide by two bullets to the back of the head. So he said, listen, he said, people kill each other over a $20 drug deal gone wrong. He said, you think people aren't going to kill you over multi-millions of dollars and power and information and military and everything else? He said, man, they'll drop you in a heartbeat. So that's part of what we have to contend with as well.
Absolutely. I think it's, you can draw direct parallels, like I say, because of the Stargate and MK Ultra. These were things that were completely dismissed as not happening,
right,
constantly, John. Same as collating information on alleged UFO sightings. Nobody was doing that.
Right, right. And then the US dumped all those files and the UK dumped all those files. It was like, oh, you mean you really were all this time? Well, well, well.
I mean, it just shows you, I'm not sure if they just presume that we're as stupid as they want us to be sometimes, John, because clearly some people will go, oh yeah, that's all stuff and nonsense. And as you mentioned a moment ago, I think often the right-wing Christian factions that are in the US government often get overlooked as to why these things get pushed out the way. Because
exactly,
there are, you know, it's like a bullfight in there. There are people who are desperately, yeah, chasing millions of dollars for black projects all the time. We know that. And I'm sure,
absolutely,
it happens all around the world in other governments, you know, and this is not,
yep,
let's not bash the American government. I know for a fact they are not the only government doing this. I would be.
Oh, absolute truth. Yeah, absolute truth. Yeah.
I mean, to be honest, I don't know what we'd be doing here, because at the minute it seems like the blind are leading the stupid in the British government. So I don't know what's going on here, John. I mean, we sold a ferry contract to a company that didn't own any ferries. So anything's possible in this country. So who knows what the reality is, like I say, because I find it, especially MK Ultra, because,
yeah,
people viewed that particular project as quite successful. Stargate was eventually hauled by external reviews from the CIA saying this is a waste of money.
Yeah.
But
or that's what they tell us anyway.
Well, precisely.
Yeah.
So once again, it's only when the evidence becomes irrefutable do they go, oh, well, yeah, actually, we have been doing this. And so,
exactly.
Why do they think we just think that they're not doing anything else? Because if they've been doing this for UFOs and desperately wrapping it up in layer and layer and layer to hide it,
right,
even from their own staff and their own finance teams,
right,
you can't tell me that none of the other projects are existing in some form or other out there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think one of the things, we'll go back to, I think this is one of the things we discussed in our last interview that didn't make it. I think one thing that keeps people from really wanting to examine this, really wanting to push for disclosure, it may be fear, and not religious fear, but just, oh my God, if they're here and they're that advanced, what are they going to do to us? I don't want to know. So that may be part of it. Another thing is that, and here's the part I think we talked about in our last interview that didn't make it. Back in 1998 in Roswell, New Mexico, there was a thing called Alien Encounter 98. And Stanton Friedman was there lecturing. I got to see him in person. I went there to do readings, psychic readings. And so one morning I always get up really early anyways. And so I was up early and I said, well, I've got to go and see before I start. I've got to go see the Roswell UFO Museum. For God's sake, I'm here. I can't not go see it. So I got there before it opened. I was looking in the windows, looking in the door, and I was milling around out on the sidewalk, just waiting for it to open. I got there, I think about 15, 20 minutes before it opened, and wasn't much foot traffic on the sidewalk. And this lady was coming down, walking towards me, and she was a little ways away, and she smiled and nodded, and I smiled and nodded, and she got closer and she stopped, and she said, oh, are you waiting to go in the UFO museum? I said, yeah. I said, she says, it's your first time here to the museum. I said, yeah, it is. And I said, as a matter of fact, it's my first time here to Roswell, and I couldn't pass up seeing the museum. And she goes, oh, well, what do you do? And I thought, oh boy, here it comes. So I said, well, I'm a psychic and I'm here giving readings. And she looked at me and she nodded and she said, well, you'll believe what I have to tell you then. I said, okay, this is getting interesting. So she said, when I was a kid, me and my brother were outside playing, and we saw the UFO come over and crash off over in the distance. And I was like, holy cow, now you have got my full attention. So she said, we were old enough and we had seen enough that we knew it wasn't a blimp, it wasn't a balloon, it wasn't a plane, it wasn't a helicopter, it wasn't an experimental aircraft. She said this was a UFO. And she said from the way it was flying, we could tell that it looked like that it was in trouble. Mm. And then we saw it crash off over in the distance. And I was just gobsmacked. I said, my God, I said, have you come forward and been interviewed or come and talk to some of these people that are doing research and things? I said, this is one of the most incredible stories I've ever heard in my life. And I've never seen you on TV or anything. And she said, no. She said, no, I've never come forward for an interview or anything. And I said, well, why not? And she said, well, she said, after this happened, we had people come around that were in the military that we knew were in the military. We had people come around that may have been in Congress or whatever. We're not real sure. And then we had people come around. We didn't know who the heck they were. But all of these sources came knocking on doors. And the basic message was, and sometimes given directly and not implied, the basic message was, if you talk about this, you and your family's bones are going to be found out in the desert. And so she said, you know, that terrified all of us. And she said, even if there was a person that said, well, I don't fear the government. I don't fear the military. I don't fear any of this. I'm going to talk. Well, they may not fear, but what are they going to do to your family? And you feared for the safety of your family. So she said that was an effective way to shut everybody up. And she said there were many of us that were threatened that way directly. They would come to our homes, knock on our doors and say, you didn't see this. And if you say that you did, your bones are going to be found out in the desert. And all of a sudden she snapped her head left and right a couple of times up down the street and said, I'm sorry, I've said too much. I got to go. Bye. Nice to meet you. And took off nearly at a run down the street. So for a lot of people, that fear is still there for the threats that they've had. And I think that's another area that we have to penetrate and get beyond and find some way to protect people when they come forward.
Absolutely. I mean, there are numerous examples of the U.S. government even doing strange things to their own staff. Obviously, the famous, famous cases, obviously what happened to poor old Frank Olson when his boss decided to dose him and all his colleagues with LSD.
LSD, yeah.
Just to test how malleable it made them. And obviously, Olson mysteriously died and never accepted the he was really depressed, so he threw himself out of the hotel window.
Yeah, I don't believe that either.
And the witness didn't hear anything. Yeah, all right.
And then the Tuskegee experiment, where we experimented on guys with syphilis.
Yes.
Or tuberculosis or whatever, and didn't tell them.
Yes.
You know, this is what's going on. It's like,
yeah. Agent Orange in prisons.
God. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
And so... If anything, John, it makes me chuckle that they think people are so gullible, and they wonder why some people are really into conspiracies. We've just named four there. There are actual facts.
Exactly. Exactly. And then I remember reading a book, you know, the United States of America. We've been one of the biggest gun runners on the planet that there is. And I remember reading a book about, it was written by a reporter, the guy that broke the story that the CIA was peddling drugs in Compton and other places to finance, you know, arms and revolution and other countries to pay for that. And I read a book, read the book by the reporter that broke that story. And it was like, yeah, you know, all of our governments do a lot of clandestine things. And they do a lot of experiments on their own citizenry. That's an absolute fact. No conspiracy theory there. It's truth. And, you know, people say, well, if that's true, why don't we rise up and rebel? Well, we have. And it hadn't done a heck of a lot of good. You're fighting money and power that's entrenched. Hmm. And I tell people, I say, one of the ways to fight that money and power is with psychic power, with spiritual power. And if we can get together and group together and use that power for a common goal to break these things open and open these things up and to make these people reveal what's going on and hold them accountable if need be, that's where our victory comes. They may have the money and power, but we have that spiritual power if we'll learn how to use it and if we'll band together in numbers where there's strength.
Mm. Something's got to change eventually, John, one can hope.
Exactly, exactly. But I think it's up to us to make that change happen, bring that change about somehow.
Definitely. Now, what's this about you buying a haunted doll off eBay, John? What was all that about? What on earth were you thinking?
My wife and I had seen a TV program with haunted dolls, and we looked at each other and said, oh, my God, we need a haunted doll. So we looked on eBay, and there's a whole category of haunted dolls on eBay. And we found one that this lady said had all these manifestations associated with it. And we said, oh, let's get that. So we did. We bought the haunted doll. We got her. We were quite delighted with her. She was as big as a toddler. She was about 3 feet tall and kind of scruffy looking and everything. But I immediately discerned that there was indeed a spirit in her. And one of the things that she would do, you know, doll's eyes open and close. Like if you lay them down, the eyes close, you pick them up, they open. Well, hers would open and close on her own while she was just standing there in my office. So I knew some things were going on with her. And so we were very kind to her, and we talked to her, and I played music for her and things like that. And one night I went to bed, and I had this lucid dream, and the doll came to me in her form, in the form of the doll that was in my office. She came to me in that form of the dream, and she said, you know, she said, you have been so kind to me and so sweet to me, and you've treated me so well, but you've kind of released me, and it's kind of time for me to go now and kind of time for me to move on. But I just wanted to come and thank you for your kindness and your sweetness before I left. And then she burst up into this pillar of flame that ascended up into the sky and vanished. And I woke up, and I was like, good Lord. So I went in my office the next morning, and sure enough, the spirit and the doll was gone. It was just an empty shell. There was nothing there. And I was like, wow, she really did come and say goodbye to me. And I opened up my emails, and there was an email from the woman that I had bought her from. And it was like, urgent, urgent, urgent. And I was like, what in the world? So I opened it up, and she said, are you okay? And is your home okay? I had this dream last night that the doll went up in flames. So that was the haunted doll story.
There is, as we were saying, it still surprises me that there seems such popular things to own. And it's become kind of a cliche these days, John, that you'll see an eBay sale with people saying, selling this lovely doll, definitely not haunted.
You're right.
Or it's in a antique fair or something. There's a comedian here in the UK called Rachel Fairbairn who does another brilliant podcast called All Killer No Filler. And uh-huh. She owns one of the ventriloquist dolls from the film Dead Silence. I think it's Billy, cool. Who's the main one. But she forgot she's bought it, and she's got it in this spare room. So depending on where she is, sometimes it'll just be stood on the bed staring out the window at her.
Yep, absolutely. So, you know, it raises the question, are objects intrinsically haunted or do they become haunted? And I think it's both.
Yeah.
I think a being, an entity, a spirit, an intelligence can enter an object for whatever reason, can even be invited in, can be invoked by a spell or an incantation or whatever. And then I think some objects in and of themselves just have a like a native intelligence or an energy or personality or whatever. And for those that think that goes a little far out, think back to when I was a teenager, I had one old beater car after the other. It was just a miracle that any of them ran.
Mm.
But I noticed one thing. If I would vacuum it and clean it really good and wash it and wax it and clean the windows till they sparkled, the car objectively ran better for 2 or 3 weeks after that. And I thought, well, maybe that's just my imagination. And I talked to friends of mine. They were like, no, happens with me, too. If I really, really give it the spit shine treatment, it runs better for a few weeks or so. So you have to understand that things don't possess an intelligence the way we think of intelligence, because when we think of intelligence, we automatically think of human intelligence.
Mm.
But, you know, look, there's plant intelligence, there's tree intelligence, there's animal intelligence. There's all these things out there that definitely exhibit intelligence and sentience and understanding and knowing and emotion. It's not human intelligence, but it's an intelligence nonetheless. And so I think there are things that kind of have that intrinsic knowing or intelligence or energy or awareness or whatever about them. And if we treat them well and respect them and respond to them, well, just like my magic rocks, that we've talked about, then the more that they exhibit that energy and that evidence of some type of consciousness or awareness.
What's the strangest haunted object that's been brought to your attention, John? Is it? Because often I've heard all kinds of things, from bookcases to bunk beds to clocks to the cliches, as we said, of thousands of dolls, it would seem, around the world. John seemed to be possessed through one form or another. Is it something that, once again, have you noticed a upturn, a trend of more people coming forward and saying there's something not quite right about this particular object? Or is it one of those things that it gets popular in paranormal culture and then it drops away again, but it's always there? It's just whenever people can be bothered to check it out.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that gets popular in paranormal culture and then drops away again, as you said. And I think that's a very accurate assessment. And I think there's some people, they may not have a haunted object, but they want to jump on the bandwagon and say they do. Or they may misinterpret something that happens as caused by the object when in actuality it's not. So, it fluctuates. It goes up and down through its ebbs and tides like everything else does.
Mm-hmm. Have you had the privilege of visiting Robert the Doll? As I know, he's not too far from where you are.
Yeah, Robert's not too far away. I've never gone and seen Robert. I would like to, but there's a lot of evidence for Robert being legitimately haunted. And apparently, doesn't like to be made fun of or disrespected. There's been some things that have happened to people that have disrespected him or made fun of him in negative ways. So these things can hold some real power, absolutely.
Yeah. I did a show many years ago, about 4 years ago, one of my early shows. We did a whole episode on haunted dolls, John.
Right.
And I was speaking with David Weatherly, the wonderful researcher. And he'd obviously done a book about haunted dolls, and we were discussing it. And I was amazed at some of the things, because obviously Robert, I was warned to be very respectful. You know, I'm not going to dismiss these subjects if
right.
And Robert's probably, for me, the one with the most evidence of being some kind of paranormal attachment to it.
Right.
I had to laugh because David was saying that people would send him presents, or they'd send letters asking for forgiveness if they'd mocked him.
Absolutely.
But they were also saying that they get a large amount of joints sent to Robert from all over the US. People send Robert the Doll a spliff for whatever reason.
That's funny.
And we were trying to think, are they saying that they think Robert needs to chill out, or they just feel he might be a bit bored in his box and he...
Yeah, there you go. Needs a little escape there, a little little pharmaceutical escape. Well, you know, it's really funny. One of the things that I've observed over the years is that the spirits seem to be exceedingly fond of gin.
Yes.
And I have successfully made offerings to gin to the spirits. One of the more dramatic examples was we have a lot of storms here, bad storms here in Florida, and of course a lot of hurricanes and everything. Like I said, I've become aware that spirits are exceedingly fond of gin for whatever reason. And living here in Florida, we have bad storms, bad thunderstorms, hurricanes, so on and so forth, tornadoes. And I would always set out offerings of gin, bowls of gin, and ask the spirits to protect our home, protect our neighborhood during these storms. And they always did. And one of the more dramatic examples, the wind was really getting up one day. It was like just thrashing the trees around in the woods behind our house and the trees in our yard. And I went outside and opened up a bottle of gin, and I took it and just flung it from left to right as hard as I could with my hand and as high up in the air as I could. And I said, please accept this offering and quiet the winds. And I did that a couple of times, and the winds instantly stopped. They didn't die down. They just immediately stopped as soon as I threw that gin up in the air. So spirits do seem to be awfully fond of gin. I can tell you that. And it is proper to give offerings to spirit. As a matter of fact, in my third book, my new book, I have an entire chapter on offerings to spirits and how and why and so on and so forth. So
yeah, it is interesting. I mean, do you think that's some kind of extension that people have continued into the modern era based on how they would leave gifts for the fae and hobbits and boggarts, John, who would be in their houses, and therefore they've continued to use that in regards to making offerings to spirits? Or do you think that primarily, I'm not aware of the Fae being very keen on gin. I might be mistaken. There could be some little people out there who have got a real fondness for that particular spirit.
Right.
Or do you think it's something completely different then?
No, I think it is an outgrowth from that. And I think it's kind of a return, and we need those returns to prior times where people were closer to the spirits, closer to the fairies, closer to the earth, closer to the sky. People made those offerings, invoked their help and invoked their guidance and respected their environments and respected the earth more. And I think it is an outgrowth of that. And I think we need to return to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you mention it, your third book is out, available worldwide for everybody.
It is out. Yes. I'm so excited about this third book. Oh my goodness. I have to tell you, I have to brag here just a little bit. As soon as the book came out on Amazon here in the US, it became a bestseller in three categories. It hit number one in Ghost and Hauntings, number three in Supernaturalism, number seven in Occult and Paranormal. Under the Hot New Releases, number one in Supernaturalism, number two in Occult and Paranormal, 24 in Religion and Spirituality. And then it hit the Barnes & Noble Top 100 Best-Selling Books at number 86. I was so happy with that. And then the Kindle books came in and bestsellers at 16 and 17. And I wanted to tell everybody, it is available now. They're in the UK at the Amazon UK. The paperback takes a bit to get because I don't believe they're stocking it right now. They have to order it from my publisher and it has to come in, so that could take like a month to get there. But the Kindle edition is available at Amazon UK right now. So you can download that immediately at Amazon UK and get the Kindle edition of my new book, 20 Ways to Increase Your Psychic Abilities. And Waterstones there offers the paperback. I don't think they offer the ebook yet, but Waterstones offers it online. And so it is available in the UK. But like I say, you can go to Amazon UK, get the Kindle edition right now. And this book is really exciting to me, Paul. Each chapter takes one specific spiritual tool or technique. For example, the first chapter is on psychometry. I define it. I lead you step by step by the hand, tell you how to learn it, how to practice it, how to get good with it, and then the real world application of it. And I've got chapters on candle magic, offerings to spirits, how to find the perfect mate, learning how to scry, that is, use a crystal ball or so on and so forth, to begin how to learn to use the tarot cards, how to conduct an old school seance, how to use the Ouija board, how to do this, how to do that. So I've got 20 chapters. And my goal in writing this book, Paul, was to say, okay, there's so much dogma and ritual and tradition out there that doesn't amount to a hill of beans. People say you have to cut a willow switch on the third full moon of the year at midnight and wear purple and shave your hair for the spell to work. And that's nonsense. What I wanted to do was take all the techniques in this book and say, if you want to learn how to do this, This is how it is. This simple, this easy, cut and dried. You don't have to have anything expensive. You don't have to search for any hard to find artifacts or herbs or implements or anything. Most of the things in this book you can do without anything or with the things that you already have in your own house. It's that simple. It's that cut and dried and that easy. And most importantly, it's effective. It works. I've taught these things to people over the years, and these are things that the other side has taught me directly that I have used and I have practiced, and I know they work. And I passed them on to my clients over the years, and I thought, you know, I need to set this down in book form and get this out there so everybody can use this, because it's simplified, it's easy, it works, it's going to bring you results if you do it like I tell you and practice it. If the persistence is the key with anything, but you'll begin to see results very, very quickly. Some people begin to see results immediately, like particularly in the practice of psychometry. The way that I teach that, most people can get results their first session. So I'm really excited for people to get this book.
What, for me, I think, John, when you create a book such as this, is the hardest thing, I suppose, looking from the outside, is, as you mentioned, how to start it. Was this one of those situations where you knew the topics that you wanted to cover and they started off in a particular order and you've moved them around? Because I think for most people who are looking from the outside in, they would probably say, well, why are you beginning with psychometry? Why not seances or something like that? What was your sort of rationale behind that, John? Because for me, yes, I'm not going to say I'm an expert, but I certainly am aware of what psychometry is and what it's used for.
Right.
I'm quite fair enough. I'm like, yeah, that's fine. But for you, is it? Do you think that's an easy lead in to these kind of subjects?
I do. Of everything that I've taught people to do over the years, because I've held little seminars and I've held groups, I've conducted all kinds of meetings and things, taught people how to do things, held little workshops and things throughout the years. And for me, the easiest thing to teach to get somebody started on is psychometry. It's just so easy. And people get good results from it right away. And so for me, that was an easy lead into the book. It's something that people can do. You just need another person. That's all you need, and an object that one of you knows the complete history to. And it's that simple. It's that easy. And so for me, it was a real easy lead in. It's something that's easy for people to learn. And it's like anything else. If you experience either immediate or quick success, you're going to say, oh, I can do this. I can do this. Let me see what else I can do. If I can learn this, I can learn candle magic. I can learn how to attract the perfect mate. I can learn how to look in a crystal ball and see things and get the guidance I need. I can connect with my guardian angels. So for me, it was like a gateway in the sense, okay, let's start them off with something simple and easy that I know they can do and get results with. And then that's going to encourage them, spur them on to, okay, well, let's see what else I can do. How far can I take this? How far can I increase my psychic abilities? And that was the idea behind opening up with it.
Mm. I mean, it was one of those things that we've spoken to on our previous conversations, John, that I was always interested in listening to people such as yourself and finding out how do you continue to develop and push yourself and sort of keep yourself fine-tuned psychically, if
right.
that makes sense.
Right.
Because yeah. I think, once again, these are presumptions for a lot of people whose only experience of the psychic world is they may go for a reading now and again. They may have been at a show at some point in the past, or they've gone somewhere and visited a resident psychic that's in situ in a particular town or city somewhere, John.
Right, right.
So for you, is it something that you've found the longer that you've done this, the best way to keep you fully charged? Or is it, as with anything, John, if you don't sort of look after yourself and eat the right things and get the right amount of sleep and hydrate with the proper things, that there'll be some days where you're neither use nor ornament, as we say over here.
Right.
Whereas
right.
other days you're like, boom, instant.
Yeah. For me, the gift has always been on and always been accurate and always been good. Even if I've been just deathly ill at the time, the gift still works. And I just have to push myself to say, okay, I feel like crap, but I'm going to do this reading and give them what the other side gives me. So that is always there. And that's reliable. Now, as far as keeping that in tune, my goal, since I was about 11 or 12, was to say, okay, Let me study everything there is out there. Let's find out what works, what doesn't, what's real, what isn't. And then I'm going to adopt that, and I'm going to study that, and I'm going to implement that into my life, and I'm going to practice it, and I'm going to practice it, and I'm going to practice it. And I'm going to see how much better I can get and how far I can develop. And I'm going to keep doing this, and I'm going to keep learning, and I'm going to keep growing. So I began to do that then. At about 15, I started reading for friends and family, psychic readings for friends and family. At the age of 18, I began to read professionally, and I've done that now for over 50 years. I've read for clients in over 40 countries, which just blows my mind. But I never considered that I have achieved my pinnacle or success or whatever. I still study. I still practice. I still strive to know more. So this is a lifelong calling. This is a lifelong thing. And it aggravates me when people think, okay, I read a book on tarot cards. I got a tarot deck, did a couple of readings. Now I'm a tarot reader. No, you're not. You know, or I read a book on being psychic. Now I'm psychic, a psychic. No, you're not. It takes a lifetime of dedication, of development, of skill, of training, of dedication, of practice, adhering to these techniques, and pushing and pushing and pushing and trying to learn more, understand more, and gain more. So it's a lifetime procedure. But in this book that I wrote, 20 Ways to Increase Your Psychic Abilities, what I'm trying to do is get the average person that says, man, I'm thick as a brick. I just don't have any intuitive knowledge or experience. I don't have any gifts. I don't have anything. And my rejoinder to that is, yes, you do. And I'm going to show you. I'm going to prove it to you. Use this book. Do it exactly the way I tell you and practice it and give it an honest chance. And you're going to discover, oh, wow, I really do have some ability here. And then for the person that has a little more than average ability, they're going to find tools and techniques that help them to grow even more. For the person that may be way up there in the plateau of psychic abilities, there may be a thing or two in there that you haven't seen before that you can learn, that you can use, adapt to your repertoire, and engage with. So the book's for everybody, but primarily it's for the person that, well, how do I get better? What do I do? And do I have any ability? And how do I increase that ability? You're the person this book was written for.
Have you found it over the years, John, that there are certain skills that you've had to work on more than others? Because once again, a lot of this is all presumption. And I am somewhat surprised sometimes where you will hear people and they will talk about psychics or whatever, as though everybody has the same set of skills, whereas that's clearly not the case and has never been so. Certain people are better at different things.
Exactly.
For you, John, has there been aspects of it that you've really had to work more to bring it up to the level of other things? Or is it that kind of, if you just practice everything, everything reaches a nice level where you can utilize different aspects at different times depending on the circumstances?
The latter. It's been that way for me. I've never said, well, I'm a psychic, but I'm not of this, or I'm a this, but I'm not of that. When I started learning, when I started practicing all of this, I was like, okay, let's see how many things are out there that I can do. Let's just open myself up to every discipline, every teaching, every experience, every technique, every tool there is out there, and let me see what I can make work for me. And I haven't found much that I couldn't make work for me and make work for me very well. And then I integrate those, like you say, in whatever capacity is needed at the time. So that's another thing I've tried to tell people over the years is don't limit yourself. Don't listen to people say, well, you can only learn this, or you can only be this, or you can only be that, or you only have a certain calling in one or two areas and other things you can't do. You can do as many things as you open up to and as you have a facility for. Now, obviously, some people are going to be more talented with dowsing rods than other people are, but that don't mean you can't take up a pair of dowsing rods and learn to use them effectively. Now, you may not become a professional water witch and run around finding water so people can dig wells. You may never get that good, but you can use them well enough and reliably enough to help you find lost objects in your house or make decisions in your life. Or I knew somebody that won the lottery using the dowsing rods that way. So you can achieve levels of success for yourself.
Hmm. I was surprised, John, to see a chapter about EVP, because it's something I love EVP. I've always been really interested in it, and sometimes it creeps me out big time, depending on what's been captured. Well, this is once again something that seemed to be everybody who was doing paranormal research till sort of the mid-90s would do EVP. And right. Then, I don't know if it's the rise of digital recording or it's once again something that's fallen out of fashion. It seemed to completely disappear off the map. I've noticed the last couple of years there seems to be a real resurgence in EVPs and right. people using it again more. Is that something that you've seen, or do you think once again it's always been there and it's just whenever it gets fashionable it drops in, it drops out, but it's always been bubbling along?
Yeah, I think it's always been bubbling along, as most of these things have. But like you say so correctly, everything rises and falls in and out of fashion, and we pay more attention to things at certain times than we do others. There are people that, in spite of everything, and in spite of all the publicity that things may get, there's still people that have no clue what you're talking about. They've never seen it, don't know what's going on. So the next time it surfaces, that may be the very first time for them. They're like, oh, look at this. And so there's always that aspect of it as well. And I think that, you know, we go through periods where technology seems to improve and offer us promises of better communication, and everybody gets all excited again. And then that kind of dies down because it doesn't go as far as we hoped it would. And then the next round of technology comes along again. What I'm waiting for with EVP, I talked to a guy one time. He was a host on a podcast I was on, and he was a professional musician. And he said, John, he said, I have software that I can take and I can load any piece of music in, any sound, anything oral, anything auditory, and oral, A-U-R-A-L, anything auditory. And I can load this into the software and I can manipulate it. I can do anything in the world I want to with it. I can change it. I can find depths of things in there that other people can't even hear, aren't even aware of there. But he said, I can load these EVP into my software, and I can find the voices, but I can't find the frequency that they're on. He said, I can ascertain the frequency of any other sound, any other piece of music, any speech, anything else. But he said, I cannot find the frequency that these voices speak on. And I told him, I said, when we can find that frequency that they use, then we're going to have real time communication just like you and I do right now. And that's going to be the exciting breakthrough in EVP.
Mm. It does seem to be something that I've noticed, especially here in Britain, more people seem to be using it a lot, more than perhaps they were at sort of the early part of this century. It just didn't seem very fashionable.
Right, right.
And like I say, John, I've always found it really fascinating. Sometimes it's one of those like, what are they saying? Why? How? But I've also heard others where it's as clear as day. I mean, obviously, on a recent episode, we've had some chuckles here because I was interviewing a guest and we were talking about a book that we'd both read. And as my guest said, oh, yeah, this book's absolutely brilliant, there is a voice on his side of the track that simply went, yes.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful?
Now, I was sat here getting the episode ready and I was like, what? My laptop's now haunted. And I checked all the tracking. I checked the original one. It was on his side. So it wasn't sort of a sort of archive sound recording that was on there. It was a fresh recording. It was done on the first time. It wasn't recording over anything else. There's no other interruption. It just particularly happened at that perfect, precise moment of the conversation where whatever that was, really like the book we were talking about, John.
Exactly, exactly. and we get those little hints. And, you know, one of the things that impedes our progress in all psychic and paranormal investigation is we have the religious bias against it. We also have the scientific bias against it, because there are scientists that go in with their mind made up that it's not possible. It doesn't exist. Therefore, why look for it? Why experiment with it? And if you do get anything, oh, that's easily explainable. I can explain that away. And that's our mindset going in, instead of going, you know, hey, there might be something to this. Let's see if there is. And, you know, I look at Skinwalker Ranch and the experiments they've conducted there and the evidence they've gotten. They've got video of UFOs. They've got video of portals. They've got video of hot and cold spots. They have video of where the rabbi came in and did the chant, opened up a portal. They have video evidence of where the Native American drumming group came in and drummed, and there was a labyrinth up on top of the mesa that began to glow when the drummers were drumming, and they caught that on video. There's video evidence of that. And when the drummers started drumming, they said, "We're seeing shadow people over here walking around, a shadow person walking around among the rocks, and we're hearing footsteps and shuffling like rocks being moved around by footsteps and things." So, you know, these things are real. They're there. But even the Native American drummers, they said, "Okay, we're kind of spooked. That's it for the night. We're leaving." And it was like, "Oh God, I wish I could have been there, because that would have been my beaten potatoes." I'd be like, "Keep drumming. I'm going to go up and see if I can interact with the ghost, with the spirit, whatever it is," you know? So we have our difficulties that impede us going forward in this, even from within the paranormal community, and especially if somebody wants to go, "Oh, well, it's demonic, or it's satanic, or it's malevolent, or this or that." And if that's your assumption going in, that's the conclusion you're going to draw. And, you know, to do better, we're going to have to marry science and the paranormal. And we're going to have to be open-minded. We're going to have to go in and say, "Okay, what if?" And then we're going to have to get those results and not explain away the results. I mean, if it is obviously explainable, where you're doing an EVP recording and this is Captain so-and-so on flight so-and-so coming into Heathrow, and you check it out and that's what was flying over and what was happening, okay, that's explainable. If you get that and there's no flight in the air that day of that number, no, nothing going over at that time, and you research, find out that the captain flew that flight and died a year or two ago, then you've got something. But you got to be willing to do that, to be open, to explore, to try. And I think we have to understand that science can't do it all. We've looked at science as being the answer to all this stuff. Science isn't even close to catching up with the paranormal. And we have to understand that. Scientists have to respect that. And likewise, there's people in the paranormal don't want anything to do with scientists. And we have to get over those biases, and we have to work together and see what we can put together.
Absolutely. I mean, you only have to look at what's happening in the news, that they think they've discovered a fifth force.
Yep.
That is very interesting, because obviously it's from a rival lab to who runs the Large Hadron Collider. So I don't know if you've got a bit of scientific rivalry going on, but they're claiming they think they've discovered another reality.
Yep.
That moves these that forces these elements in our world about.
Right.
Which,
right.
Once again, it's always surprising me that you will hear blasé statements about, "Well, science has the answer to everything." Well, it's only got the answer to what we've done so far.
Exactly.
And,
exactly.
And when we try and explain what's going on the other side of the universe, yes, our understanding is that the laws of physics must be the same wherever you are. But, you know, there are planets in our solar system that have got moons where it rains liquid nitrogen and the temperature's 1,000 degrees,
exactly.
John.
That goes back to the point of, we look through everything through human eyes and through human understanding to this,
yes,
point. And we say, "Well, physics has got to be the same throughout the universe." No, it doesn't. Stanton Friedman, who I mentioned earlier, the great nuclear physicist and ufologist, he wrote a book called Science Got It Wrong. And he was a physicist. And he said, "Look, here's all the cases where science assumed things, presumed things, whatever, and they got it wrong. Science made these statements, these experiments, these postulates, whatever, and they were wrong." Mm. So science does get it wrong, just like we get it wrong. There is no science is not foolproof. There's no fail-safe in science that makes it immune to error. You know, we have to understand that science is conducted by human beings. Human beings are prone to error, and we have to understand that. So we have to be open-minded on both sides, and if we can marry this together in a way that nobody goes in with a preconceived notion, but goes in with the idea of, that's kind of like why I like what they're doing at Skinwalker. They go, "Hey, let's do this and see what happens." Mm. "We got a response. Let's do more of this." And they repeat it. But at the same time, they need some good shamans or some good psychics or some good mystics out there going, "Okay, this is who you provoked, and this is who responded, and this is the message they want to give to you, or this is their lineage of being here, or this is their reason for being," or whatever. That's what they're missing to me.
I mean, it is remarkable, as speaking from my personal opinion, John. I've got a wide range of interests in all different aspects of weird and wonderful things.
Right.
And what we knew 50 years ago about the vast majority of them is very different today. And often there seems to be this perception, as you said, science is infallible, as everything is often portrayed in certain aspects, but they're not. People make mistakes.
Exactly.
I mean, I've been waiting for cold fusion since they started banging on about it, since the mid-1990s, John. That's never turned up.
Exactly. Yeah.
Anti-gravity, exactly right. You know, we were all supposed to be in flying cars by 2023.
Yep.
Where's that gone?
I know, exactly.
And it's surprising sometimes that when certain other scientific disciplines or fringe things, such as cryptozoology or spirituality and things like that, are often poo-pooed as being weird, and then you look at some of the other experiments that have gone on, the people that have made massive broad sweeping statements, and it suddenly you never hear from them again because they couldn't do it anymore.
Exactly.
And that sometimes seems to be that in certain scientific disciplines, if it doesn't work, then they just stop talking about it, nobody mentions it anymore.
Yeah.
Whereas when we talk about parapsychology, cryptozoology, anything like that, people go, oh yeah, it's full of hoaxes, look at that, fake. They couldn't repeat that. That's not true. But hang on.
Yeah, but what people have to understand, just because you can fake something doesn't mean that the original or the real doesn't exist.
Yes.
You know, you can fake a diamond, but there's real diamonds out there. You know, you can fake meat now. You know, Burger King has the Impossible Burger, which is a veggie burger. It's not meat, but there's still meat, you know, out there. Just and magicians love to say, oh, well, whatever a psychic does, I can duplicate that. Well, sometimes I can, sometimes I can't. But anyways, if they can duplicate something, just because they can duplicate it doesn't mean that the original, the real, doesn't exist and that there isn't someone out there that can really legitimately do that.
Mm. Do you think that as they're doing it at Skinwalker Ranch and certain other things, attacking certain aspects of the weird is best going at it with a broad bag of tricks, John? Because often you will see certain researchers or certain investigations where they seem to be hell-bent on using one particular thing.
Right.
And they're not getting the results. And then they just go, well, we're not using that anymore. We'll move on to something else. Instead of doing four or five different things to record what they're trying to catch or get evidence of things, do you think that's more to do with people only having a sort of tunnel vision in regards to certain aspects and not being more flexible?
Exactly right. It is. And I think that what you have to do is use that shotgun approach that you're talking about. You take a variety of instruments and you say, okay, what's working today? And maybe the spirit on the other side that's trying to communicate can use EVP to get through you today. Maybe tomorrow they're having difficulty and all they can do is set the REM pod off. Mm. Well, you say, okay, the REM pod's working today. Let's use it like they did with the table tipping in the old days. One tip for yes, two tips for no. Give me one blink of the light for yes, two blinks of the light for no. And then maybe the next day the REM pod doesn't work, so you can go to something else. You use something else. So I think you have to have that multidisciplinary technique when you're investigating. And I think you have to realize one of the examples that I've given is that when I was a kid growing up, say a kid, I was in my teens, when I was growing up in West Texas, we knew a guy that had a shortwave radio, a ham radio. And on a good night, when the conditions were just right, we could talk to the UK. We could talk to Australia. We could talk to all these faraway places. And they were so clear, it sounded like they were in the same room with us. Mm. And we might talk 15, 20 minutes and amazed at the culture because gas was so cheap in the U.S. then and it was so expensive in the U.K. And we were like, oh, my God, are you serious? And we were just amazed at this interaction, this communication. The next night, we might have a hard time reaching somebody across town. So it had to do with the radio waves, the electromagnetic setup of the planet and everything that was going on. And I think it's the same way with communication with the other side. Some conditions are ideal. Sometimes you get a lot of communication, really heavy, really fast, maybe across a range of instruments. Another night, only one thing works and works sporadically. Still another night, nothing may work. And we have to understand that instead of saying, well, communication stopped. No, it stopped for that night. You stay there for weeks and you keep experimenting and you keep exploring and you keep documenting what you've received. At Skinwalker Ranch, they didn't shoot one season and say, well, that was pretty interesting. Now we're going home, going to do something else. They keep going. They keep going. They keep going. They keep exploring. They keep trying new techniques. They bring in the rockets. They bring in the drones. They bring in the shamans. They bring in the drummers. They bring in the rabbi. They bring in this. They bring in that. And that's exactly what you have to do. And you have to find out what works best and pursue that line of communication. But that line of communication may only work best that day or for a few days or that week. And then whatever conditions that enable that in the atmosphere may change, and we need to use something else. Doesn't mean the spirits have left. Doesn't mean that whatever is there has gone away. It means that maybe it just can't communicate using that particular channel any longer. We got to switch channels. We got to put the scanner on and see what clicks, see what intercepts.
Mm. So for anybody who buys a copy of your latest book then, John, what for you is probably the key thing you want somebody to take away from it? Is it a wider understanding of the subjects that you cover, or is it perhaps discovering a latent talent that they weren't aware of, or is it to have a more enjoyable view of all aspects of what people can do rather than, say, focusing on Ouija boards or scrying or tarot cards? Having more weapons in your paranormal arsenal.
Well, that's it. You know, my wife calls it a psychic toolbox. She said it's full of all these things. You can reach in, you can take out what particular discipline you need for whatever particular thing you're going through. And there's a lot of things that overlap in there. You can use disciplines for more than one thing. And I think for me, the most interesting thing is to take and awaken people's potentialities to themselves and to the other side, that connection with the other side, that it is real, it does exist, you can contact it, it can help you, it can lead you, it can guide you, and it can make your life better, it can even save your life. And one of the examples I give in there, I'll never forget this. You know, we neglect the world of dreams, and I have a chapter on dream interpretation. I have a little bit about engaging in lucid dreaming. I have a little bit about instructing yourself to receive guidance from your dreams when you go to sleep. You're going to dream. You might as well try and get some guidance out of it. And one of the most dramatic examples, I had this friend that worked for the National Security Agency here in the U.S., the NSA, and he was a code breaker. And he told me, he said, John, we have this code. And he said, we threw everything that we had at it, all of our manpower, all of our machines. We couldn't crack this thing. We worked on it. We worked on it. We worked on it. And he said, I became obsessed with it to the point that it exhausted me. And he said, I came home one night. I was in a suit and tie and my dress shoes. And I literally didn't loosen my tie. I didn't take my jacket off. I didn't even take my shoes off. I was so exhausted that I stood backward at the foot of my bed and fell into my bed, totally exhausted. And he said, I immediately went to sleep. I was so tired, and I immediately began to dream, and it was a lucid dream. And here was this ticker tape parade going across the screen, like on this ticker tape, like on Wall Street that you see. Mm. And he said, here came the characters in that code across this ticker tape. And he said, I thought to myself in my dream, oh my God, it's followed me home. It's in my dreams. It's in my mind. I'm going to go nuts. I can't escape this thing. I'm going to go crazy. I'll never get any peace from this. I can't escape from it. And he said, suddenly the second ticker tape appeared right below it and began to stream below it. And he said, it was the English translation of the objects in code, the symbols in code that were going across above. And he said, I woke up instantly and I remembered enough of it that I grabbed a pencil and paper and I wrote it down. I rushed back into the office and that was it. And we broke the code. And so we have to understand that the other side can communicate great things to us if we'll take the time to learn how to tune in, to practice tuning in, and then to act on what we get. And that's one of the things I hope people take away from this. It's not a book of party tricks. It's not for you to amuse people with. It's for you to gain real solid things in your life that you can use and make your life better and improve your life and get a better connection with the other side in a positive way, where you can get intuition, you can get guidance, you can be led, you can have protection, you can know things that you need to know.
Excellent, excellent. Well, it looks like an excellent book. I mean, you've got a wonderful foreword as well, written by J.V. Johnson.
Yes.
Someone you've I would imagine, have met on many of the paranormal circuits over the years. John, how did you get to know J.V.?
I've been on J.V.'s show. I've been interviewed by him, I think, 8 or 9 times now. And we become friends through that, and I respected him and what he's done so much. You know, he was with the original Ghost Hunters TV. He's done, right now, he's got Paranormal Reality TV. He's done Paranormal in Real Life, Beyond Reality, The Independence Gang. And I've been interviewed by him, like I said, several times. We became friends, and he was very complimentary towards my psychic talents and abilities over the years. And I said, you know, I'd appreciate it if you would give me a foreword, if you'd write the foreword for this book. And he graciously did, and included a really wonderful story in there to boot. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got the foreword from JB.
Yes, I did like his description of being as sensitive as a brick.
John. I know, right? And I think a lot of people feel that way. And it's like, you're not as sensitive as a brick. You just haven't been taught how to be sensitive, how to receive, how to understand, how to get these things. And that's what I do in this book, is teach you how to do that.
Yeah. Have you had any more visits from some of your beloved former pets recently, John? I know whenever I speak with you or think of you, I always remember that wonderful story you told me about Gizmo.
Yes,
And obviously I know you've had some incidents with Poe as well. Have you had anything else recently or any sort of weird visitors?
I have. It's so amazing. For people that want to read about Gizmo and Poe, that's in my first book, Writing with Ghost Angels and the Spirits of the Dead.
Yeah.
And in the story of Gizmo, there was a little kitten that it was actually our neighbors, and he preferred us to the neighbors, and he came over, kind of became our cat.
Yeah.
And he was a little tabby, gray striped tabby kitten, and one of the absolute sweetest animals I had ever known in my entire life. And I would pick him up by his little paw and hold him and sing to him, and we would dance around the house, and he would just purr and purr. He was just so delightful. So we were sitting there one Thanksgiving Eve, and we had a storm door that was had a glass that slid down over the screen. You could slide that up so the air would come in through the screen door. And it was a warm Thanksgiving Eve. This is back in West Texas. So we have the glass up on the storm door where the breeze could come in. And I was watching TV, and Gizmo ran over to the door all of a sudden and began to just frantically claw and meow and claw at the door and just rake at it and claw at it and rake at it. I was like, what in the world? He had never acted like that. And I said, okay, let me watch my program. I'll let you out here in a little bit. And he just kept on. It got worse and worse and worse. And I was like, well, for God's sake, okay. So I got up, went over and let him out, went back to the TV. And it wasn't 5 or 10 minutes later, the neighbors came over, knocked on the door and said, Gizmo's laying out in the street dead. He just got hit by a car. And I was like, oh, my God, no. And I went out there, me and my daughter went out, and we got him, and we buried him, made him a little grave. She made him a little cross out of popsicle sticks with his name on it, and we put that on his grave. And so years down the road, and I had this big red Doberman named Elsa. And she was infatuated with Gizmo, and he just kind of ignored her. And she just wanted so much to explore him and smell him, get his attention. Well, she was a big old 100-pound gal, just big old muscular Doberman, and sweet as could be with me and with him. But just he was kind of intimidated sometimes because she was so big. Mm. And so down the road, my wife and I divorced, and I took Elsa. We moved into the old family home, and all this is in detail in the first book. And My mother had died. My sister moved out, and it was just me there by myself. And we had a washing machine in the house, but we didn't have a dryer. We had a clothesline out back when we went and hung the clothes out on the clothesline to dry. So I was one bright, sunny morning early on a weekend. I was out changing a burnt-out porch light, a light bulb in the porch light on the porch. And from around the corner of the house up under the porch, running like crazy, meowing like crazy, come this gray tabby cat that was a spitting image of Gizmo grown up. And I was just shocked, and he just came running toward me, just talking and talking. And he began to claw at the screen door to get into the house. And I stepped down off the stepladder, and I looked at him. I said, Gizmo? And he just came over and was rubbing on me and purring and loving on me. And I opened the door, and he shot inside. Mm-hmm. And about that time, the dryer stopped, or the washing machine stopped, rather. So I said, okay, well, I got to go hang the clothes out. And so he was rubbing on me, and I was petting him, and he was just carrying on. And so I got the clothes in the basket. I thought, man, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. And in the flesh, for God's sake.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't believe it. And opened the door and went out to go to the clothesline. I was carrying the clothes basket, and he would leap up in the air and rub against the basket and then come down and rub against me and just talk. Well, as soon as Elsa caught sight of him, she let out this yelp that was almost like a scream of recognition. And he saw her and went running lickety-split for her pen and lay down on the sidewalk in front of her pen and was reaching underneath and rubbing and rolling. And she was just pawing at him and just grinning, and just they were just going crazy like old-time reunion. And I was like, my God, this is the most incredible thing I've ever seen in my life. And so I finished hanging my clothes out, and she, the gizmo, I'm sure, was still over there with Elsa. And I was like, well, I'll go in, and stereotypical of the time, I'll get a bowl of milk and put out. And so I went in, got a bowl of milk, came outside and called, here, giddy, 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 went around the corner. No cat. Never saw him again. Never had a stray cat in the neighborhood at that time. And so I was like, my God, I said, Gizmo came back in the flesh to visit with me, to visit with Elsa before going on again to let me know that he's okay and that we'll see each other again someday. Hmm. So all these decades later, my wife and I moved to this other home now in Florida where we're at. And my office faces the backyard, and I have these security lights installed, motion sensor lights installed in the front and the back. And the one in the back is right over my office windows, big window in my office. And I always get up real early. I'm usually up around 4 or 5. And I was up one morning, and through the blinds, I saw the lights go off in the back, the motion detector lights. So I came in my office and opened the blinds. I thought, what in the world set the blinds out? So I looked all around the backyard, couldn't see a single thing. I thought, well, that's weird. And I thought, okay, so whatever. So I closed the blinds, went on about my business. And then that night, I was sitting in the living room with my wife watching TV. And you can see into my office from the living room. And my wife was up, and I was sitting in my chair. She was up doing something, kind of coming in this direction, I think. And the lights went off again in the back. And I said, hon, run back there. Run back in my office real quick and open up the blinds and see what's setting that off. And so she opened up the blinds, and she said, well, my God, or something to that effect. And I said, what? What is it? She said, there's this large gray tabby cat sitting out there staring straight into your office window, just staring. And I said, you're kidding me. And she said, no. And the description she gave me matched exactly the description of Gizmo as he was. And before I could get up out of my chair and get there, she said, he just got up and just walked off and just kind of disappeared as he walked off. Hmm. I was like, so I feel sure that Gizmo came back again in the flesh to say, hey, still here, still remember you, still love you. We'll see each other again someday.
Oh, it always makes me feel warm and fuzzy, that story, Jim.
Yes.
I mean, obviously, it's something that's always interested me in regards to this. Do you get people who are wanting to reach out to a beloved pet? I would imagine you do, John, like I say, because I'm being house sitting for my mum, who's one of her former pets comes right back in the form of, he used to wear a big silver chain, and you can hear it banging on the bowls in the kitchen occasionally.
Yes, absolutely.
Her current dog doesn't have that particular chain and doesn't make the same noise when he's eating.
Right.
And sometimes you think, oh, I was sat at her house the other day, I don't know, 10 o'clock at night, and I suddenly heard this jingle jangle, and I thought, oh, must be my dog, because I was doing a bit of dog sitting, so I'd fetch my dog over to look at with my mum's.
Right, right.
Turned round, my dog's fast asleep, sat next to me. My mum's dog sat looking in the kitchen with his head turned to one side. The noise went on for about 30 seconds. As soon as it stopped, my mum's dog went into the kitchen then.
Yep. And that's evidence that people, you know, our pets do love us. They do hang around. They do come back. They do give us signs that they were there. I write about not just Poe and Gizmo in the first book, but about the deaths of our three cats. And they all died at home, and they all had little peculiar quirks, little particular toys they favored, or like you say, little particular sounds that we associated with them that they made. And as each one died, not only us, but the remaining cats would hear those exact sounds that were associated with the cat that had died. and would perk up and run and look and alert to those sounds. So we heard them and the animals heard them. So they are capable of coming back and communicating with us, letting us know that they're there. And that's something we should be aware of and be open and receptive to.
Well, without wishing to sort of gloss over the fact that you've got a highly successful book out there at the moment, John, that's hit the shelves in the last couple of weeks.
Right, right.
You've already started work on the next one, which is intriguingly titled The Crying Tree and the Magic Rock.
Yes, yes, my fourth book, and I'm about two-thirds of the way through it. And it's going to be kind of an amalgamation of book one and book two. New adventures, new experiences, revisiting some old experiences and updating those, and also some stories that I've never written about before from my childhood that I think people are going to find really, really amazing. So it's going to be a fun book. That's going to be out hopefully early in 2024.
Fabulous. Can't wait for that one. Well, John, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you.
It's a delight. I appreciate it. It's wonderful. Wonderful.
It's always lovely. Even when our conversations don't record, John, it's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Absolutely.
So where can everybody get hold of your work, follow you online, and keep up to date with what you've got going on, sir?
Go to johnrussell.net. John Russell, all one word, J-O-H-N-R-U-S-S-E-L-L, johnrussell.net. There I've got links to my books. You can get a reading with me if you desire, so on and so forth. Find out all about me. Each book has its own website as well. So you can go to writingwithghosts.net, knockintheattic.net, or 20ways.net, and 20 is spelled out, T-W-E-N-T-Y, 20ways.net. And each book has its own page with a description that tells you about the book. It's got endorsements, reviews on there, and multiple links where you can buy the book. And like I say, it is available now at Amazon UK. At Waterstones and various other places in the UK, so people can get that there as well.
Fabulous. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes to make it easy for everybody to track you down, John. And as always, I just want to say thank you so much. Glad to hear you're on the mend after your recent operation.
Thank you.
I look forward to speaking to you next year, no doubt, when the new book receives.
Absolutely, we will. It's been a pleasure, Paul, as always. I appreciate you having me. Thank all of the listeners. And grab that book. You won't be sorry. And yes, definitely see you next year when the new book comes out. Thank you, my friend.